I'd invite you as a congregation, those who are here for adult church, to take your Bible, to turn to Mark's Gospel. This morning we continue our study in the Gospel of Mark. We're in chapter 7. We're going to look at verses 24 to 30 of Mark chapter 7. Let me give you just a little bit of background in case you haven't been here before or you've missed something. Let me just kind of catch you up a little bit. When you get into Mark chapter 7, you notice that the chapter begins with the Pharisees accusing Jesus of not enforcing proper standards of cleanliness among his disciples. And they're really not worried at all about hygiene, but for the Jews, there was such a thing as ritual cleanness. They sort of understood their relationship with God and their holiness before God to be a matter of fulfilling certain rituals. So for the Jews, there was animal sacrifices. For the Jews, there was observance of certain days. For the Jews, there was people that you could associate with and people that you did not associate with. And also, they were very concerned about what you ate and whether or not you ate with holy hands. And so they had a whole system, and it's not recorded in the Old Testament. This is something they made up traditionally of how to have your hands holy or clean enough to eat so that uncleanliness did not go into you. They accused Jesus' disciples of not doing this, and that's true. Jesus' disciples were not following the Jewish traditions of hand washing. But then Jesus turns to the Pharisees and says, how you misunderstand the whole concept of what is clean and what is unclean. And he says, you know what? It's not what goes into a man from the outside that makes him unclean. It's not that you've come into contact externally with stuff that's made you unclean. In fact, Jesus says the uncleanness or the unholiness of every person comes from within. Out of our heart proceeds all of the expressions, very sadly, of uncleanness. And he gave us a bit of a list in chapter 7. Now, Jesus has to explain this afterwards to his disciples, because though he is speaking to the Pharisees, the disciples are not very quick to understand what he's saying. And Jesus says something rather pointed to his own followers who are with him constantly. He says, are you also so clueless? Is basically what it says in the Greek. Can you guys not pick up on the whole idea that it's not externals that make a person unclean, but it's the heart of an individual that makes them unclean? In other words, our sin problem is an internal problem. We are sinners by nature and by choice, unfortunately. That's what we've looked at so far in chapter 7. Now, as we get farther in to chapter 7, verses 24 to 30 this morning, we're going to notice that Jesus shifts his ministry from Galilee, where he does most of his earthly ministry, and he now goes to the north and to the west into a Gentile region. It's the region of Tyre. And we need to understand something here this morning, and that is that the gospel of God, the good news that comes through Jesus Christ, by Jesus Christ, and in Jesus Christ, was not only intended for Jewish people, though they received it first. God also intended this good news to go to the rest of mankind, because he was going to establish a people for himself from literally all the ends of the earth. And for most of us sitting here this morning, we are not Jewish, we are Gentiles, and it's wonderful to know that we've been included in God's kingdom and in his family and in his people, because the gospel extends farther than just the Jewish nation. When Jesus goes to the region of Tyre, as he does this morning, this is significant, because these particular Gentiles, those who inhabit the region of Tyre, were probably considered the most unclean of the unclean. Tyre is a region that the Jews just had a real disdain and dislike for. If you understand anything about Jewish culture in that day, probably the people that they generally disliked the most and despised the most were the Samaritans. But if you're in Galilee, that northern section, Galilee had its own special hatred for a people from Tyre. They were considered the bitterest of enemies. That's what Josephus writes for us. The Galileans absolutely hated the people from Tyre. Now, it's significant that Jesus goes to Tyre, to the unclean of the unclean. I want you to remember back in chapter 7, I think it's verse 19. It's a little comment that's got brackets around it, so this is a bit of an editorial comment that Mark made. And Mark says, "And by this Jesus declared all food clean." If you've got a New American Standard, you should notice that the word declared there is probably italicized. If it's italicized, what does that mean? That means that it's been supplied. It's not there in the original text. In fact, I think we get a little bit misled when we think that Jesus just declared all food clean. What Jesus actually did, and what the Greek actually says, is that Jesus made all food clean. It's not just a verbal thing. He's actually able to make something clean. Now, you have to think about unclean food. You know, the hand-washing stuff that the Pharisees were pushing, that has no part of the Old Covenant. But unclean food is definitely a part of the Old Covenant. And how can Jesus go against the Old Covenant? Well, you have to remember something, is that the covenant is something established by God. And Jesus doesn't go against the Old Covenant. What he does is he fulfills and wraps up the Old Covenant and says, that's now done, and he supersedes it with a new covenant. By the way, who can supersede a covenant of God? Only God. Jesus is God, and he's going to establish this new covenant, and he has the capacity to make things clean. He not only makes food clean, but amazingly and wonderfully, and praise to his glorious name, what else does he make clean? He makes people clean. Because he's already said that the uncleanness does not come from the outside. The uncleanness comes from the inside. Therefore, how can people ever be made clean? Only God can make something unclean clean. And that's what Jesus is about to do by establishing the new covenant. Jesus would bring a true and eternal cleansing from sin. And he would include both the Jews and the Gentiles. And that's important. Now, Mark's gospel is full of irony. We've seen a number of places where there's this, you know, odd contrast. You say, you know, I know that's true, but it almost seems like it's not true. That's what an irony is. It's true, but it just doesn't really appear to be. And here in chapter 7, I want to contrast what we've looked at so far to what we're about to look at. What we've looked at so far in chapter 7 is a group of Jewish men, the Pharisees, who defend their traditions and reject the witness of Jesus' divine power. A group of men who say, no, Jesus cannot be acting in a godly manner, and they uphold their tradition instead of the reality of what Jesus is so clearly showing. Now, the irony is that this is going to be set against what we're going to look at this morning. Because what we're going to look at this morning is a single Syrophoenician Greek-speaking woman. Compared to a, you know, powerful, influential group of Jewish men. We have a single gal. She's Syrophoenician. She's a Greek speaker. But unlike those Pharisees, she completely trusts in Jesus' power, and she does so basically by his reputation alone. The Pharisees witness all that Jesus does and reject him. She hears about Jesus, and she's there, trusting him. Wow, what an irony we have here. This contrast actually gives us a bigger picture of how God has designed redemptive history. Have you heard that term before? You know what history is? Redemptive history is how God's plan for the spread of the gospel and for the salvation of mankind to become his people, how it actually works according to his perfect will. God has designed redemptive history. He has exact things going to happen at exact times in the exact right way so that he can bring about exactly the result he wants, and he will bring salvation and call a people to himself through a new covenant. That's redemptive history. And this thing shows us a little bit of this. Because the Gentiles here are not an afterthought. Oh, well, it didn't work with the Jews, so we'll go to plan B, the Gentiles. That's not how it is, folks. Because the Old Testament very clearly foretells that Jesus would call a people from the Gentiles as well. And you know what? The Gentiles are not just fill-in family members for God. They were part of God's design from the beginning, and though Jesus goes primarily and first to the Jews, he most certainly does not leave out the Gentiles. he will call Paul as his personal representative to go out and to establish a church among the Gentiles in the very near future. But when we think of Tyre, please understand that this represents sort of the one of the most extreme expressions of paganism that any Jew can imagine. When Jesus leaves Galilee and goes to Tyre, those who are already critical about him must have become so much more critical. Why would you leave the people of God to go to those people? It's kind of like Jonah. Do you remember the story of Jonah? A prophet of Israel who God sent to Nineveh, by the way. Nineveh is the capital city of Assyria. Assyria in those days were the most vile pagan people in the entire world. And did Jonah want to go and preach to them? Well, what a glorious place to go and preach. That's why Jonah, you know, got on that boat so that he could get to Nineveh faster. By the way, Nineveh is inland. A little hard to get there by a boat. He gets there by fish. Well, we don't know if he gets there by fish or not, but the Assyrians who worship the fish god must have been quite amazed when Jonah has the fish in the story. Anyway, Jonah goes to Assyria and he preaches the most feeble six-word sermon that has probably ever come out of the mouth of a preacher. And he has the most glorious results that has ever probably come to a preacher, where 200,000 people turn to the Lord based on a weak six-word sermon. And then Jonah is so thrilled he praises and thanks his God. No, then Jonah is so upset that he goes out and says, I knew this was going to happen. Why didn't you strike me dead? I didn't want this to happen. Those are the worst of the worst, and now you have saved them. They've come to your grace. You understand the confliction in Jonah? Well, it's kind of like the same confliction in the Jews here. They don't want the Gentiles to come in. They've got the Jonah problem. The Messiah came to make the unclean clean. The problem here is that even his disciples are struggling to understand what makes a person unclean and what can cleanse a person. You see, the disciples of Jesus, including the apostles, were struggling with a cultural norm. They really thought they understood traditionally what holiness before God was and what cleanliness before God was and what uncleanness before God was. And their cultural norm was obscuring the truth. And Jesus kept putting the truth out there and they weren't catching it. So it's time now for a field trip to the land of the unclean. You might as well go to Tyre, to the unclean of the unclean. And we assume that the disciples went along here. And now Jesus will expand the gospel. What better place to teach resisting learners than to take them to the very heart of all they considered unclean? Let me read the passage. Mark chapter 7, beginning of verse 24. Jesus got up, went away from there to the region of Tyre. And when he had entered a house, he wanted no one to know of it. Yet he could not escape notice. But after hearing of him, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of the Syrophoenician race, and she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And Jesus was saying to her, let the children be satisfied first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and to throw it to the dogs. Oh, that's not what you expect. But she answered and said to him, yes, Lord, but even the dogs under the table feed on the children's crumbs. And he said to her, because of this answer, go. The demon has gone out of your daughter. And going back to her home, she found the child lying on the bed, the demon having left. This is a most interesting story this morning. It's not a story, it's a historical account. Let me give you a little bit of an outline. The basic idea is that Jesus will cleanse the unclean. Mark has already said that he can do it with food. Well, now Jesus is going to prove it by doing it with a person. And he's going to cleanse the unclean of the unclean. So we've got 4 points. Number one, an unclean problem for an unclean person in an unclean place. That's what we're going to look at. Secondly, we're going to look at the idea that this cleansing follows a perfectly established order. God knows exactly what he's doing. Thirdly, that cleansing results in humility and understanding and faith. Cleansing results in humility, understanding, and faith. And the final point is that cleansing involves receiving Jesus at his word. Cleansing involves receiving Jesus at his word at face value. There's cleansing. All right, let me begin back in verse 24. Jesus got up and went away from there, so he has been ministering in Galilee, but now he is going to go to a different place. He is going to go to Tyre. Tyre would have, you know, you come into some of these towns nowadays, they have the home of, sort of a boasting sign at the front of the town. Tyre is the home of Jezebel. One of those really sweet gals of the Old Testament. Jezebel is among the worst of the worst. And Tyre kind of boasts her as one of the citizens there once upon a time. Tyre is thoroughly pagan. Jezebel was thoroughly pagan. That's why she brought such grief to the northern kingdom by influencing Ahab to follow all of these hideous practices of this region. When Jesus goes to Tyre, please understand that this is a very deliberate destination that he's going to, and he has a very deliberate purpose in going there. Nothing in the will of God happens by accident or by chance. God knows what he's doing. Jesus knows what he's doing. And yet, this is going to be a low-profile visit. Look what it says. Jesus got up, he went to the region of Tyre, and when he had entered a house, he's not out in the streets preaching, he's not out in the marketplace preaching, he immediately goes into a house, and he wanted no one to know of it. That is because we don't have any record in the Gospels of Jesus having an extensive preaching ministry in Tyre. When he goes to there for this particular time, it's not on a campaign, but there's a very specific reason, and I'm going to suggest to you that that very specific reason is that his disciples need a real good object lesson, and Tyre is going to provide it. And though he wanted no one to notice, no one to know of it, that he was there, yet he could not escape notice. He was noticed at least by one person for sure. And this again would be the hand of God orchestrating events. But when he goes to Tyre, please understand that he is going to a very, very unclean place. Holiness does not have much of a foothold in Tyre. Verse 25 says, "But after hearing of him, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately came and fell at his feet." Now, that's kind of a long sentence with clauses and subclauses. It's always important, especially for somebody who's trying to read this in the Greek, to figure out what is the main verb here. And you've got three things here that look like verbs. After hearing of him, that sounds like a verb. A woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately came, that sounds like a verb. And fell at his feet, that sounds like a verb. Anybody here, can you guess what the verb is? Now, if you know Greek, please don't help the rest of them. In this case, the verb is fell. And those other two participles just modify that verb. What I'm saying is, the emphasis of this passage is, a woman came and fell at Jesus' feet. Now, what does that mean? It was uneven ground just before Jesus. She tripped and went down? No. This is clearly understood, especially in that culture, as an act of submission, an act of worship. She has come, she may have had him by the ankles, she is down on her face in front of him. Now, why is she doing that? Well, it tells us. The immediately in my version is attached to the word came. Actually, in the Greek, it says, and after hearing, she immediately... That's what the immediately modifies. I mean, she came as well, but she heard that Jesus was in Tyre, and that means that this put something into action for her. Now, we know that Jesus is known in the region of Tyre because back in Mark chapter 3, when he's doing part of the incredible ministry that he's doing, it says that it was spreading the news and people from Tyre were coming to Galilee. And you got to think, in those days where there is no appreciable medical system, there are no medications to take, when you got sick, what happened? You put a little oil on yourself, you went and offered something in front of the idol, and you hoped you didn't die. Especially in Tyre, that's what happened. But Jesus is being reported, and you got to think that Jesus has done thousands, if not tens of thousands of miracles within a couple days' walk of Tyre, that this reputation is just spreading throughout the ancient world. There's actually somebody who can provide real relief, and not only relief from illness, he can actually heal. And if you came back a year later, the person was still healed, which kind of distinguishes healing nowadays from healing. I hear people talk about being healed, but they're back in the same condition 3 months later. That's not healing. That's getting a little temporary relief. Jesus was actually healing. So this woman had heard of him, and she wanted to know who he was. She had a little prior knowledge. She only knows Jesus by reputation, and she only has a really tiny little bit of revelation. So we must assume, therefore, that this woman must be really spiritual, right? That's the way people think nowadays. If God notices you, it's because you're really spiritual. If God answers your prayer, it's because you're really spiritual. If God heals you, it's because you got massive faith. That's what we're taught. Verse 26. Now the woman was a Gentile. That word there is she's a Hellenized woman, which means that she is thoroughly immersed in the culture and education of the Greeks. She's a Greek speaker. So she's certainly not Jewish. That made her an outsider according to the Jews. But there were a number of Greek-speaking Jews even that came into Jerusalem, the Hellenists. And there were some, you know, proselytes of the gate who were Greek-speaking Gentiles who understood the significance of God working through the Old Covenant, who were kind of attached to the Jewish people. But that's not this gal. This woman was a Greek speaker, a Gentile of the Syrophoenician race. That means that she is born and bred and raised in Tyre. That means that she is a pagan of the pagans. She is unclean of the unclean. And ladies, forgive me for what I'm about to say, and she was a she. What difference does that make? Well, if you understand things from the culture of the day, and particularly from a Jewish perspective, women were considered unclean. Jewish rabbis used to pray something like this in the morning: "Thank you, God, for not making me a sinner, a Gentile, or a woman." That's absolutely vile. Let me be clear about that. And not only was this a gal from an unclean place, who herself would have been considered unclean from every possible perspective, she also had an unclean problem. Because she was, it says, she had a little daughter, verse 25, who had an unclean spirit. Three times in this passage, the entity that oppresses her daughter is called a demon. That's normally how we would see it, and that's what he's called three times in this. But in this particular thing, she is called an unclean spirit. That's still playing on the whole idea of cleanliness and uncleanliness. You see how this ties together. She has an unclean problem, and that is her little daughter is oppressed by an evil spirit, by a demon. Now, this is going to be a powerful object lesson. It's going to go down in the Gospels for us to read throughout the history of the church. And it's going to be a powerful object lesson for the disciples who are there. Because if we're going to talk about Jesus being able to cleanse what is unclean, for him to be able to clean this situation in the most unclean place with a woman who would be considered most unclean, who has a most unclean problem because of the affliction that her daughter has, this is going to be Jesus showing that he is able to clean the most unclean thing you can ever imagine. Some of you are sitting here this morning and you have shared with me, you know, Pastor, I'm not like the rest of the people in the church. They're all pretty good people. I'm really rotten. You have a funny view of the people in this church if you think they're really not that bad. Because we are all corrupt to the soles of our feet, from the top of our head, from inside of each one of us pour forth the uncleanness and the filth. So even if you have done more unclean things, this is not a contest, folks. Nor should you feel inferior to anyone else in this congregation, because we have all been made clean by the only one who can make us clean, and we are all unclean in the eyes of a holy God. But isn't it wonderful to see that Jesus is going to go to the worst of the worst in the worst place and deal with it? Jesus cleanses the unclean. This is an unclean problem for an unclean person in an unclean place. Verse 26, we heard who this woman is. Now we notice what she's doing. And she kept asking him. That word there in the Greek means that it was continuous. She didn't just ask Jesus once. She kept on asking. In fact, the disciples, being the great lovers of humanity that they were, in Matthew chapter 14, is that what the account is? Matthew 15, where we have a parallel account here, say, Jesus, send her away. She just keeps bugging us and shouting after us. Get rid of her. But Jesus allows her to ask many times. And you're saying, why? And my suggestion to you is because there's something important to learn here. This is a lesson that needs to be learned. And so this poor gal keeps asking him over and over again to cast the demon out of her daughter. For the Jewish disciples that are following Jesus, they don't even understand why he would pay any attention to her at all. God's plan was for the Jews. God's plan was for Israel. The covenant was given to Israel. Now stop for a second here and think. Why was Israel in a covenant with God? Had they earned the right to be in a covenant with God? Never. When God established that covenant with Israel, they were the least of the least. There was just nothing special about them at all. But because God brought them into a covenant relationship with himself, they now had that. This poor woman from Tyre didn't have that yet, but it's coming. And even though the Old Testament so clearly states that God would establish for himself a people from all the nations, the Jews just couldn't see the point of bothering with this. But here I want to make a point. God has a very precisely ordered sequence and timeline for his plan in redemptive history. It's precisely ordered. It is a sequence. It is a timeline. And it's part of his plan. And there is covenant number one, which the Jews understood that they were in. God established a covenant so that he had a covenant people for himself. Israel, the original group. But in God's precisely ordered sequence and timeline and in his plan, covenant number one was designed to be superseded by covenant number two. There was a new covenant coming. You can read that 700 years before Jesus in the prophecies. And covenant number two, the new covenant would be established by his own son, by Jesus. Covenant number one was established with Moses' mediator. God establishes it. And though Israel gets the gospel first, and remember, we're now only a few months away at this stage of Mark's gospel from Jesus going to Jerusalem where he will be crucified. Though Israel gets the gospel first, the Gentiles get the gospel next. It's not an either or, it's both in their proper order. It's kind of like when Paul writes in his letters that the gospel comes to who first? Jews. Then to the Gentiles. By the way, being second in line is in no way making you inferior. I know in our culture, everybody has to be first or nobody can be first. We have this strange idea of equality. When God designs it so that the Jews get the gospel first and then the Gentiles, it's not because he likes the Jews more than the Gentiles. It's just according to his perfectly designed plan. This woman needs to get this. That she is also part of the outreach of the gospel. And you know what? The disciples need to get this as well. Here we have a sense in which Jesus is going to do something for this Syrophoenician woman, but it is going to be a cleansing that follows a particular order, a perfectly established order, because every detail, every sequence, every timeline will be fulfilled in divine perfection. It's kind of like when Paul writes to the Romans and he says, you know, Romans chapter 5, verse 6, while we were still helpless, at just the right time, Jesus died for the ungodly. God's timetable is perfect. And then Jesus says something here in verse 27, and this bothers people because we always think of this, you know, incredibly kind, gentle, generous Jesus who puts no difficulties on people. And then Jesus responds. And verse 27, my version says, and he was saying to her. That's another imperfect in the Greek, which means that he didn't just say this to her once, that there was a sense in which he was saying it over and over again. She was asking over and over again, Lord, cast the demon out of my daughter. And he was saying to her over and over again this, let the children be satisfied first. For it is not good to take the children's bread and to throw it to the dogs. Now, the first thing I want to talk about here is that word dogs. Nowadays, dogs are people too, and I hate to tell you this, they're not. But if you love your doggy, that's okay. Who am I to say anything different? And people think I'm an animal hater, and I'm not. Believe it or not, long before I ever wanted to be a pastor, my life's goal was to be a veterinarian. See? Look at the laughter. I do not hate animals. I cannot stand the way people treat their animals. That's why I couldn't become a vet. Because I can't say, there, there, cat mama. It's all okay. Anyway, back to this. The word dogs here, and you know, the Jews, the word dog was a very derogatory term. They always called Gentiles dogs. Dogs were coyotes to them. They were scavengers on the outside. They carried filth and disease with them. There was nothing good about dogs. You didn't find a whole lot of Fidos and Sheps and Lassies in the Jewish household. Didn't have a lot of them as pets. But the Gentiles, more so. And the word here for dogs is not the usual word, but it's a diminutive form that Jesus uses. These are the doggies. The little dogs, the pet dogs. And that is significant because it really sounds very, very harsh. But you know what? What Jesus is saying to her, if you actually listen and clue into what he's saying, is not that harsh, but it is very distinct. You don't take the children's bread and throw it to the pet doggy. Jesus is saying this over and over again, and she is asking over and over again to have his help. Now, what is Jesus doing here? I believe that Jesus is trying to get her to actually understand what he is saying. And at first glance, because she is so caught up with the emotion and the concern and the desperation that she has to help her daughter, that she probably doesn't catch it the first couple times. Notice that little word, first. Jesus said, let the children be satisfied first. That kind of speaks to that divine order that I said was in here earlier. But it also gives hope. Because if Jesus had just said, let the children be satisfied, for it's not good to take children's bread and throw it to the dogs, would that mean that the dogs would get anything at all? No, but when Jesus says, let the children be satisfied first, what does that imply? That there's something else that's going to happen. There's second coming as well here. And what is the second that comes? Is that, you know what? Not only the children are going to get something, but the little doggies are going to get something too. He says, let the children be satisfied first. He went to the Jews first. After about 2.5 years of ministry, the Jews should have been satisfied. By the way, how well were the Jews responding to the gospel? Everything was being obscured in their traditions. Everything was being obscured in the unmet expectations of what they thought a Messiah should be. Everything was being obscured because we're just kind of evil by nature. And Jesus was being rejected because of our evil nature, the Jews' evil nature. And as he says this several times, verse 28 gives us, the light just came on. You know, when you get the cartoons and the light bulb goes on over somebody's head, bing, what does that mean? Idea, understanding, comprehension. Ooh. But she answered. All of a sudden she stopped asking and she started listening And then she was able to give this answer. And this is one of my favorite answers in the entire scripture. This is brilliant. Now, she says, "Yes, Lord." Ah! Because he says, children first, then doggies. Yes, Lord. Now, what's the big deal with her calling him Lord? Well, she's a Syrophoenician, Gentile, outcast, worst of the worst. Everybody called Jesus Lord, right? Do you know that in Mark's gospel, only one person calls Jesus Lord? It's her. Jesus refers to himself three times as Lord in Mark's gospel. People don't pick up on it. This woman, who understands so very, very little, all of a sudden can say, "Yes, Lord." Now, I've got to ask you a question here. Do you think that, you know, eventually she just kind of dug down deep to that place where faith hides and humility hides and understanding hides? We all have this because we're really not that bad. In each one of us, there's a place, you know, of hidden faith and hidden... I hope you understand I'm being facetious here. What happened between the cries for help, Jesus finally getting her attention, and her being able to answer in this way, "Yes, Lord"? What can I suggest to you? That all of a sudden this woman was made new in Christ. Snap that quick. Because those who are dead in sin do not have humility, and she has humility. Why? Because she's willing to be a little doggy. She has no problems with that. "Yes, Lord, but even the little doggies," and she uses exactly the same word. See, she's picked up on it now. "Even the little doggies under the table feed on the children's crumbs." How did she all of a sudden gain this humility and this understanding and this faith? Because in Matthew's gospel, Jesus commends her for great faith. Well, understand, folks, that great faith is always a gift from God. And that he had an appointment with this woman because this woman's name clearly was written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and she was chosen before the foundations of the earth. There is no accident. There is no mistake here. Jesus was going to Tyre so that he could show his disciples what the spread of how the gospel was going to go and how redemptive history was going to go. This is a beautiful thing. This is God's hand at work. And you do see in this woman humility and understanding and faith, but the humility and the understanding and the faith are a result of being cleansed by Jesus. They are not what got her cleansed by Jesus. This is kind of when you look at John's gospel, John chapter 6, verse 44. Jesus says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him." John chapter 3, when Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, and Jesus says, "Unless a man is born again." And you know what? I'm not sure that we should use that word "again" there. That's a possible translation. A better translation is there, "unless a man is born from above." In other words, unless God breathes life into that individual the way that he did with the mud in the Garden of Eden and gave life to Adam and Eve originally, unless God does it, there is no life, there is no response of faith, there is no humility, there is no understanding. But this is what happens here. And that answer is so incredible. "Oh yeah, but I'm happy to be a doggy, Lord. I'll take any crumbs that fall." Hey, folks, I have news for you. When I get to heaven, if they send me into a closet and tell me to clean toilets forever, hallelujah. I'll take those crumbs, and I'll take far less. Because it's all grace. I don't deserve anything but condemnation and punishment. This is something the Jews did not clue into. Ironically, The Pharisees rejected Jesus. Ironically, the disciples struggled to understand this. Ironically, a Gentile woman of the Syrophoenicians. When Christ is presented to her and when life is breathed into her, wow, she responds the way that you respond with new life. Humility and understanding and faith do not bring about cleansing from Jesus, but instead they're the evidence of cleansing from Jesus. And Jesus says to her, because of this answer, you know what, this is just the proof of the Father's grace and His mercy and His choosing and His calling and His effectual saving power. Because of this answer, Jesus says, you can go. The demon has gone out of your daughter. And it says, in going back to her home, she found the child lying on the bed and the demon having left. We assume that demons usually put people into terrible convulsions. They tortured them in many ways. And he may have gone out with a final convulsion, and then she had peace and rest, and she was comfortably snoozing on the bed. And for a mother coming in who has known her daughter to be oppressed by demons for who knows how many years, what a glorious, blessed thing this was. There is my sweet little daughter at rest. And why? Because Jesus has the power to cleanse. He has the power to cleanse this woman, and He has the power to cleanse and to throw out the unclean spirit from her little daughter. It's just another beautiful display of authority in the gospel. You see, all the way through this account, Jesus is looking to be simply taken at His word. He speaks God's own truth, and His own disciples are struggling with this. Remember chapter 7, verse 18. Are you still so clueless? Can't you take me at face value? Well, now He brings them to a place where, man, what else could this be? You know, the problem is, by the time we get to Mark chapter 8, they're still clueless and struggling. By the way, I find hope in that because I am very excellent at being clueless and struggling. And the Lord needs to speak to me multiple times before, oh, the light bulb comes on. Sometimes it's a burnt out light bulb that gets up there, but you know, it's there. We struggle with this too, folks. The disciples were struggling. We don't seek out the truth of God, what He says. We don't pay enough attention to what He says. And then when we do understand what He says, we don't do it. Wow, you see, cleansing involves taking Jesus at His word. I mean, the whole of the gospel is Jesus declares the truth of God, the plan of God, the glory of God. He reveals God. You got to take Him at His word. The Jewish leaders refused. The disciples struggled. And yet, as we get into this Gentile turf and this ministry, it's amazing how the Gentiles reveal this remarkable willingness to take Jesus at His word. Jesus brought the gospel according to God's plan. The gospel includes both Jews and pagans. If you're feeling bad this morning as a pagan, we're all redeemed pagans. Called by grace, redeemed by grace, kept by grace, eventually glorified by grace. That's what we are. All are cleansed by receiving God's truth at face value, because we're all unclean. And here's the reality of this statement, or of this whole passage. Only Jesus can cleanse the unclean. Thank God. Amen?